Thank you for the beautiful hotel. The towels are so fluffy, I could hardly close my suitcase. I'm serious. Okay. This is a spouses panel, right? And because I don't have my spouse here, I didn't think I was on the panel. Read the information, right? So what do you want us to talk about? Growing in sobriety with a spouse? Okay. All right, anyway, hi everybody, I am Marty J. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Great to see all of you. And this growing in sobriety, it's really interesting because you hear people say, you know, you do the first 9 steps once, and then the rest is maintenance. And you hear people quote constantly that my sobriety is contingent on the maintenance, right? The maintenance of my spiritual condition. But they miss the second part in the big book where it says that we will die if we don't maintain and grow our spiritual condition. So there's a million miles between those two things, and it's what tripped me up for just about 3 decades in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't see that grow thing. I thought, like, once you got in, you admit that there's a God, you admit that you aren't that God, and that, you know, you're willing to lay yourself down and help others. I kind of thought, well, I'm here. I didn't continue to grow in my spiritual condition. And like anything else, when you're coasting, you never go forward coasting. You'll either go sideways or you will go backwards. And so I started to go unravel. I started to have those old thoughts and all of those kinds of things. So growing in sobriety is not some sort of a little suggestion. It's the first requirement of emotional sobriety. So we realize that we're powerless over alcohol. That's simple, because when I drink, you know, I wake up on the horse in front of Walmart or in the, you know, Anglican church, peeing in the back row, or I wake up and I do these things and I can't control what I'm going to do. So that's nothing. That's easy. I get that. But this whole notion around my life becoming unmanageable, that's a whole nother level of understanding that I am not ever, not ever going to be in control of my life. So step 3, really honestly, is about I don't have problems. We have problems. Once I understand that it's me and God, and it's not just so I come to this thing this weekend, I've been sick for a month, I thought, how am I going to do this? I can't even stand up. And I say to God, we have a problem. And he said, well, you know what? You just be willing and I'll get everything straightened out so you can get from here to there and everything's going to be okay. Just like it always is, Marty, calm down, right? Try this, shut up, get in the car. Remember 1976? And that's what I did. And here I am, and I'm just getting stronger and better and stronger and better by the moment. So talking about spouses, though, it's an interesting thing. I had a guy get a hold of me early in my sobriety, the same guy that told me I had a biochemical genetic disorder centered in the hypothalamic information control center of my brain, Bob. And he said, I want to have lunch with you. I'm really interested in you. I thought, of course you are. So, and he said, at this lunch, he said, I've been watching you in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm kind of, you know, and I keep thinking, you are probably the worst lover possible. So what? I said, what page is that on? He said, don't start that with me. You haven't even read the book, okay? So don't. What he said is, I you are so selfish. I keep looking at how beautiful your wife is and how selfish you are, and I figure you've just got to be awful in bed. So I said, what's your point, Bob? And I'd make it really quickly, you know? Because, like, what are you talking about? He said, from now on, he said, when you go home, and I want you to take a shower. He said, not only the groups would appreciate that, but your wife will appreciate that. Take a shower. And then he said, when you go to bed, he said, I want you to get in bed with that beautiful wife of yours. I want you to slide your arm under her head gently And I want you to tell her how much you appreciate the fact that she took care of Donovan while you were acting like an idiot, and how she has been so good to you and for you since you met. And then I want you to just lay there and shut up. I said, how am I going to do that? He said, you figure out a way. So I did it. I got in bed. I was all clean up. I had cologne on. They should have an Airflate sick bag when I tell this story, really, honestly. But anyway, so I'm in bed, and I've got my arm under her head, and we're just kind of breathing in, breathing out together. And she has no idea what's going on. So she says to me, are you having an affair or something? Like, what? I said, why would you ask that? And she said, well, you're acting weird. And I said, well, I'm trying to act loving. And she said, like, knock it off. It's really weird. So Bob C. taking me for that lunch changed my life in that area of my life. I started to understand about, you know, sharing and pleasing one another. And I've learned in marriage, as in Alcoholics Anonymous, as in business, as in life, is the golden rule. You know, treat others as you'd like to be treated. You know, if you want a great marriage, you want a great relationship, be that thing that you want the other person to be. If you feel like you're not being loved, love. If you feel like they're not doing anything for you, start doing things for them. And just keep it up regardless of what the other person is doing. A whole bunch of Alcoholics Anonymous is about learning to get over this notion around instant results. It does not work like that. And so you keep doing the right thing for the right reason, and you get a right result. Or a divorce. It just depends. You see what I'm saying? They eventually will say, I didn't sign up for this kind of affection. Take off, you know? Second thing that happened was, you know, after Bob had the How to Make Love, which was really gross, by the way, conversation with me, I come home one night with my sponsor, Shrek. We're sitting out in front of the house, and he says, do you know what Tradition 2 is? I said, yeah, it's something to do with the group conscience. And he said, yeah, it says that for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he might express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. I said, good for you. You did that really well. What's that got to do with me? He said, your marriage, your family is a group, and it is not about you telling everybody what's going to happen and when they're going to be there and what they're going to do and taking ultimate responsibility. And how many bank accounts have you got? I said, why? He said, because I'm just, how many? I said, five. He said, how many does your wife know about? I said, one. He said, you're getting my point? Like, you are not in a relationship with this woman. This was a hostage taking. He said, what you need to understand is that you are not the authority in that house, and everything that came out of the 1950s about you being the man of the house and all that, let it go. You need to start having family meetings and doing things together and planning and coming to a group conscience about the things that you're doing. So I'll just tell you one quick story around that. In the 80s, I had nine newspapers. I had founded a franchise in Canada, 65 store franchise. I was happening, you know, I was making a lot of money, and I had become extremely isolated and apart from my spouse because I just worked all the time. The kids used to call me Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob's home, you know, because I was on airplanes all the time. So I get this opportunity to go to Miami, Florida with General Electric, and I sat the family down and I said, this is what this is, and this is the risk. It was a big risk. And we agreed as a family that I go. And so I was in Miami, Florida. The guys that I had gotten into business with were complete immoral people. They were doing very nasty things, hostile takeovers, horrible stuff. And so I said, I'm out of here. And that cost me 500 grand to get out of that business. I came home and I had lent two guys $484,000 to continue their business. AA guys, just coincidentally, I'm not saying AA is bad, they lost it all. So in 2 days, I lost $984,000. I called the family together and say, whoops. And my middle son said, you are so stupid. But it was such a relief that I had told them what we were doing. They had bought in on the risk of what we were doing. And nobody had any resentment toward me. It was like a family effort. I'm really happy to tell you that because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to go and buy that, the guys that lost the $484,000 for me, I was able to buy the assets of that company back and rebuild that company. I made about six times what they had paid for it. And so it all turned out happily ever after. And all I ever did in the middle of all of that was try to help them, to help themselves. One of them walked away and is still mad at me to this day because he lost my money. I'll leave that with you for a while. But that's why Al-Anon makes some good sense, you know. Anyway, it all turned out very happily, and the family was able to unite as a unit around that. And so everything that I had trouble with in forming a relationship, you know, it says in the book that we have a handicap, that we have trouble with personal relationships. It says that we're sensitive. That hurt. And it says that we have unreasoning prejudice, which means I have something brilliant landed on my head at some point in my life, and I just know that that's the truth. I've never checked it out. I've never reasoned it through. I just know that that's true. Like that I am the one that's supposed to keep all the secrets in the family, do all the work in the family. It's me, 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 me. I don't know where I got that idea, but it was wrong. So to grow in sobriety, what I need to do, the first thing you need to do if you want to grow is let go of the size you are. We need an Alcoholics Anonymous to understand that we will continue to grow if we continue to expose ourselves to this whole notion around God and me. I saw a bumper sticker, and I'll close with this. I think it was the most accurate statement I ever heard. It said, if God is your co-pilot, change seats. Change seats. That's the growth, is to understand that by letting go, you actually gain more control over the good things that are going to happen to you. Thank you for letting me share. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. And I would like to thank Cynthia and Dave and the committee. I will thank them greater tonight, but this is just an absolutely wonderful event and all the work that's gone into it. And it's just so lovely. I'm just, whoever thought a street drunk like me would end up here? It is all because of God and AA and Bill and Bob and what I've been given here. I am so very grateful, you know, to have lived on the street and then to wake up in the morning and see the beauty I see all around me. Truly great events will come to pass. So I am here to speak about growing in sobriety, and my growth has come, it's not an original thought, but my growth has come through relationships. Carl Jung, who is mentioned in our book, he said that we only grow through relationships. It can be marital relationships, it can be work relationships, it can be any type of relationship, or it can be a relationship with God, any kind. So my greatest growth have been through relationships in my 33 years of sobriety. There's a wonderful article that's recopied in The Language of the Heart, called Emotional Sobriety, that Bill Wilson wrote. And he talks in there a lot about the problems we have. He says old timers who have so-called fixed the booze, they have the booze cure, suddenly realize they're not doing well emotionally. And he said part of it comes down to the fact that we have these unrealistic expectations. He talks about romantic urges quite appropriate to age 17, not appropriate at age 47 and 57. Now, there was a study done at Yale University long ago, a long years ago, and it was on alcoholics at various stages of sobriety and various ages. And the findings were, across the board, two were present in every alcoholic, no matter whether they were 90, 50 years sober, 1 year sober. And what were they? Emotional immaturity and deep sensitivity. And a certain degree of childishness. I reported that to my sponsor. So, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Edmonton, Alberta, on the 10th of August, 1984. And I had great guidance from the old-timers. I was age 40 when I got sober. And I had been married three times. And they did not go well. And so the old-timer said to me, "Mary, we usually say no relationships for a year, but for you it's two, because you have a propensity for getting married." So when I was 2 years sober, I moved to Toronto, and had a great sponsor called Rini. I believe in strong sponsorship. Because the other thing that Bill talks about in emotional sobriety is this terrible dependence we have on people. I was utterly and completely dependent on alcohol, pathologically dependent on alcohol. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I transferred that dependence. I transferred it onto my sponsor, who was directly related to God, of course, but it was the sponsor here. So I had Rini as my sponsor, and she died with 53 years sobriety. She was a wonderful woman. So I was 2 years sober, and I was at a meeting one Sunday morning. And now I was red hot AA, but I was crazy. You know, crazy. They used to call me Bill Wilson's granddaughter. I'd be running around Toronto telling them all they weren't doing it right, you know, and I was just not right in the head. It took me a long time. And anyway, one Sunday morning, I looked down the table and I saw him. And I just knew that God had sent me my reward. I was 2 years sober. And he had these beautiful AA eyes. And I had my AA eyes. You think the light on the eyes is spirituality? Sometimes it's psychosis. I was 2 years sober. He was 5 years sober. If he was attracted to me, he was not right. But he was lovely. So here's what happens when you haven't had, you know, it says in Appendix 2 of the Big Book that we have to have a personality change in order to have recovery from alcoholism. So here's what happens when you haven't had the necessary personality change to have a good relationship. You're sober, you're good, but you're just not right yet. And might never be right yet, trust me. And so you still go to a lot of meetings and you're on your peacock feathers. And someone asked you to read How It Works. And my eyes would flit across a crowded room. And I would see John sitting there with his eyes, you know. And I could imagine John and I wandering off into the sunset of the spirit with Bill and Bob in heaven saying, "Bless you, my child." Carl Jung slightly to the right. It was a beautiful vision, and I shared it with my sponsor, who had no romance in her soul. And Rini said to me, "Don't get married, you're an emotional retard." Oh, you think that's funny? And I knew she was jealous. So John and I eloped. And we got married in Melbourne, Florida. And we came back. And here's what happens in the close intimacy of marriage. When you haven't had the necessary personality change to negotiate a good relationship, when you don't have the emotional sobriety, the emotional maturity, which means I really care about what you think. I really want to hear what you have to say. I am stuck in ism still at 2 years. I, self, me. That's it. So in the close intimacy of marriage, one by one, the peacock feathers start dropping off. And in the end, all you have is the same two old turkeys sitting staring at one another. And one day, we were arguing, and because when I am in an emotional state, and by this time I'm like 3 years sober, and we were having a really bad argument. I love John, make no mistake, and he loved me, but we just could not live together, but we tried. And we were arguing one day, and he said something, and I had that, have you ever had that emotional blank spot? Yeah? And I picked up a knife. I did not pierce skin. I want that. So I called my sponsor and I told her what happened. And she said I had to leave. Well, him and I used to argue, I'd get up and drive to Florida. Now, that is not same behavior. There's not much emotional balance in that. That's running away again. So she told me I had to, by the time I was 5 years in that relationship, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. In the end, an old-timer, Ernie, who knew me in the beginning in Edmonton, he called me and said, "I want you to get out of there and go and check into the YWCA, downtown Toronto, and get to 2 meetings a day and turn your will and your life over to the care of God." And I did that. I went out. Let me tell you, it's really an ego buster to be living at the YWCA when you're 5 years sober. But it was a safe place for me. And I did exactly what he told me to do. In those 5 years also, because John and I were in the stock market, the big stock market crash that happened, we lost everything. Absolutely everything, play in the margins. Now, it's really a test of your spiritual condition. When after Black Monday or Black Friday or whatever they called it back then, you realize that not only have you lost everything, but that you owe the brokerage $600,000. And that was a very difficult thing to negotiate financially. Literally left with nothing. So we wandered along a bit then, and we became friends again. And in fact, so much so that I moved back into the same building. We didn't live together, we're back in the same building. And what happened then was at 9 years sobriety, John and I signed a separation agreement. And 3 days after the separation agreement, when we were about to get the money back, because he was a brilliant man and he'd sued, and he'd found an obscure clause, and it was written up in all the newspapers, and it proved that the brokerage was wrong, and we were being awarded all this money back. John and I went, signed a separation agreement. We fixed out everything financially. And the day we were to go and get it all fixed out, because the money was in escrow, I couldn't get him on the phone. And I thought, there's something wrong. And I went upstairs. I still had a key for his apartment. And I tried the key in the door, and the door was bolted on the inside. And a neighbor came, and I said, is John's car down there? He said, yeah. So we knocked down the door, and I got in, and I found John lying on the ground. He'd had a massive stroke. And according to the hospital, he'd been lying there for about 2 nights and 3 days. And he was turning purple. And the doctor told me if I hadn't gone in then, he would have died. And when I saw him, my heart broke. And I had the greatest sense of love and compassion that I have ever known by seeing that suffering that I saw him lying in so alone. The windows were open, it was March. He just had on his underpants. He was turning purple, so isolated and alone. And you know the loneliness of the alcoholic. And I did not want to see him like that. And he was in hospital for 18 months. He could never speak again, and he couldn't understand the spoken word. And now he was a lawyer. He'd been a brilliant, articulate, intelligent man. He couldn't even read. They said it was like he woke up in China and everybody's speaking Chinese. There's only two words my husband could say, and I can't say them from the podium. But what they mean is, take a journey. And he had right arm paralysis, and he taught himself to walk. His leg would drag, but he taught himself to walk. And eventually, they called me down to the hospital, and they said that through aphasia, training, etc., trying to communicate with John, he wanted me to take him home. Now, all the money was still tied up. This is 2 years now afterwards, because I had to put him in behavioral therapy. And all the money's still tied up, and none of the money will ever get fixed because it has to be kept with a lawyer now. I had to go to court. I had to walk through that. And the only way I walked through that was with God and sponsorship. Because also in emotional sobriety, Bill talks about depression. He talks about having, he thought one more time, depression was going to take him to the cleaners. He wondered why God couldn't relieve him from this. He wondered why the 11-step prayer wasn't working for him. And believe you me, I know about depression. Because prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to be in the fetal state in mental institutions with depression. I understand depression. And I never thought I would feel depressed in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when you see that amount of suffering, when you are that financially insecure, when you have nothing that's holding you up, then you realize that the consciousness of the presence of God becomes the greatest factor in your life. I have no medication in me. I have nothing. I just have the consciousness of the presence of God and an utter and complete dependence on my sponsor. That's where I have to walk through this. And I got the strength and I got the power to do it because I was thinking about John. I wasn't, no longer was I self me. I truly knew for the first time in my life at 45, 46, whatever the hell I was back then, about loving another human being and having that ultimate compassion. It was such a gift to me. And I had those moments of almost ecstasy when I see John smile. Just a brief second of union with God because of another human being and seeing what I can do for him because he became totally dependent on me. And they asked me to take him home. And after about 2 years, I took John home. And I had him home for about 5 years. And as I say, he couldn't understand. He'd meet neighbors in the hallway and he'd say his two words. So I had lots of explanation to do. And before John had the stroke, he loved the United States of America. And he always wanted to settle there when he retired. So what I would do is I would take him down to the States two or three times a year. We'd drive down. And he used to hum Night and Day and pat my cheek. And when we crossed the border, he'd take out his little U.S. flag and wave it. And when we were coming back into Canada, he'd take out the little Canadian flag. And if the Canadian immigration said anything to him, he'd say his two words. There was a very funny thing that happened to us once. I was coming back from Florida. We were driving through Georgia, and he had a way of letting me know when he wanted to go to the little boys' room. And I was speeding. Okay, I was speeding. I can't rationalize it here. I was speeding because I like to speed. And all of a sudden, I see the police car and the lights. And the policeman comes, he says, you know, you were doing whatever in a 40 mile. I don't know how much I was doing. He said, there'll be a fine for that. And I said to him, well, can I give you a check? He said, we don't take checks from Canadians. He said, but there is an ATM conveniently located next to the police station. And because I had explained to him that my husband had wanted to go to the little boy's room and was why I was speeding, using John as an excuse. And he said, he was looking at John, and John had a way of, you could tell from looking at John that he was not right. And he asked me if my husband could speak, and I said, no, he's had a severe stroke. He has no communication skills. So anyway, we get back to the police station following the police car, and I said, I will go to the ATM and get money and pay this fine. And so the policeman said, well, I'll help your husband out of the car, and we'll take him into the police station for the washroom. So he goes to help John out the car, and John gives him his two words three times over. And because remember, John's an alcoholic in recovery and does not like policemen. As a lawyer, he was locked up more times than he locked anybody else up. And the policeman said to me, you told me he couldn't speak. I said, that's all he can say, so help me God. That's it. You know, call the hospital, check it out. And he laughed. So by the time we got back to Canada, after that last trip, John began to take a dip. And the paralysis eventually went to his throat. When I married John, he was 6'2", 240 pounds. By the time he died, he was 138 pounds. Because all he could have was a phasic suit. And just before he died, in October 20th, 2001, I read him How It Works. And eventually got his body when it was still a wee bit warm and held it till he grew cold. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had done something of worth for another human being in my life. Both my parents were dead by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, never known as this drunken daughter, where she was. Never knowing, never having any peace because of my horrendous alcoholism. So you see, God works in mysterious ways in order to give us the lessons that we need in life. And I am so grateful because that is the most spiritual form of loving I have ever known. And John remains with me. I was just talking about him this morning, my sponsee and I. And I knew him, and what a gift he really was to me, to learn. You know, as Bill said, if you read that essay, Emotional Sobriety, Bill says that in the end, it all came about getting, I don't know about you, but I know Bill Wilson and me, our favorite topics was ourself. You know, Bill Wilson and me were endlessly fascinated by ourselves. You know? And as Bill said, that coming out of the depression, there's not often in sobriety I felt myself going into a little depression. But it is usually because I am becoming one more time into myself. Life is becoming about me, not about my sons, not about anything, my grandchildren. It's all about, everything they do is, it's all about me. And that's when a depression can start. It is a self-obsessed depression. And I know that now, and I don't stay in there any longer. I get out of it. Bill said at the end of that emotional sobriety that, yes, it is getting out of myself by working with another human being that I learn about growth in this wonderful fellowship. And I am so, so very grateful. Because, you see, I do believe this. I don't know when I'm amended out. I can do all the amends I think I have to do. But that amends list sits in the eyes of God. And God, I could have said no to John when the hospital asked me to take him because it was I had him home all those years. I couldn't work. Thank God the money that we got back, handled by lawyers and banks, was able to give us a good lifestyle where he could get to do the things he wanted to do. So the consciousness of the presence of God becomes the greatest fact because the consciousness of the presence of God means that I am here for a purpose and it's not about me. It's about the relation. I am here. You will hear many times it said that God doesn't give us more than we can handle. Well, God doesn't, but life does. And God will give us the ability to grow and walk through these things if we say yes, if we keep an open mind. And that's all I got for now. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. And grateful to be sober. And I want to thank Cynthia and David for asking, inviting me and my family. I want to apologize. I made the mistake. My wife's been sober a little bit longer than I have. I've been sober since March 6th of 93. And I told her she hates speaking, just so you know. And she's great with sponsees and loves all that. But this, just she hates. And I said, well, you're going to speak on this panel. And she says I gave her the wrong time, and I've been married 23 years to her, so I'm going to agree with her. So she's doing an excursion with our children. So I'm really grateful to be sober. How many people in the room, if you can just raise your hands, are sober like less than 5 years? Really? Okay, that's amazing. How about over 15 years? Yeah, I mean, because we're down here in Puerto Vallarta, you know. I'm really glad. I've never heard Marty speak. I've heard his tapes. I've never met him. But Mari and I have spoken at a few conferences, or at least one conference. One of my favorite people. She knows a lady who actually dragged me out of the streets and got me sober. I mean, really took me. I had just gotten out of prison. It was 1992, and I was homeless, and I was going to AA meetings. Really didn't want to be sober. I just didn't want to go back to prison. I just spent, pretty much 7 years in prison. And I did six, got out, and then didn't listen to the rules and went back for a year. And when I came out the last time, I was 29 years old, and I drank, and I started going to AA meetings. My professor did one of the kindest acts anyone's ever done. He didn't violate me. He said, you know, after 7 years, Brian, sending you back for 8 months is not going to work. He says, I'm going to do you a favor and send you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he broke his anonymity and sent me to you people. And it was there that I met this lady from Toronto where she met me, her and her husband, and they pulled me off the streets and gave me a job and changed my life. The kindness of another person just changed the whole trajectory of my life. You know, I've been sober 24 years, been married 23 years. I have two amazing kids. I have a career. I was not where I thought life was taking me or where I was taking me. So I'm really grateful. When I heard Mari was going to be on the panel, speaking this weekend, I was really excited. That dear friend worked for me for about 5 years. So I worked for her in early sobriety and then late sobriety before she retired from 75 to 80 years old. She worked for me at this treatment center that I'm the CEO of, which is really weird. Someone asked me one time, what qualifies you to be the CEO of a treatment center? And I said, absolutely nothing, really. I've been sober a long time, and I know how to run a business. That's about it. And I'm open to wherever God takes me. I really am not. Vonoy's not here. I think she's born and raised in Texas, but I'm not from Texas. I live in Texas, but that's not really where I want to live. I made a third step decision in April of 1993, and God has taken me many places, and I'm just open to wherever He wants me to be. So when we talk about growing in sobriety, for me, I could talk, I'm not going to, but I could talk for hours about how I didn't know what was on the other side. My first journey, when I started going through the steps, I just didn't want to drink. I could not drink. It didn't matter what conditions were on. It didn't matter what was on the line and what was going to happen. I could not stay away from it. I had no power not to drink. And it was baffling. And when I met this guy, I relapsed. I was sober for a year working at this other treatment center. And just so you know, I'm only working in treatment recently. I worked in marketing most of my life. But I worked in this treatment center this lady owned. And I stayed there a year. I was going to two meetings a day. And I really thought that the whole thing was, if I just don't drink, I'll be okay. And that's kind of a lie. I got 9 months sober, and I started getting really uncomfortable in my skin, and then I drank at a year sober, about a year and 2 weeks, and for 3 months, I did this in and out, in and out, in and out, and then on March 6th, I got intervened on, and I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he told me to read page 84 to 88 in the big book, and I remember reading it, and I remember thinking, why is he having me read this? Because that step 10 and 11 has nothing to do with, I'm just like a day, 2 days sober. But one of the promises in there changed everything about my passion or my willingness was that what it says we will recoil as if from a hot flame. And that got my attention. That was my first experience of just wanting not to drink. I didn't really want a relationship with my creator. I was an atheist when I came to AA. I had tons of reasons why God didn't exist. I mean I had a whole, I remember one of them was, where was God when I was in prison? And this guy said, just so you know, God doesn't rob banks, you do. And he's had this ability to blame God for all my problems and not take responsibility. Anything good I took responsibility for. I took credit for anything I did good, blame God for everything. I had a whole list of things, I'm 5'1", totally unfair, right? I mean, well, the average female is 5'6". That's so not fair. I was molested when I was a kid. I had a whole thing. My brother died of leukemia. You know how you just have all these reasonings that there's no God? So I wasn't interested in growing spiritually. I wasn't interested in that. I just didn't want to drink. And as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, some magic happened, and I started to build this relationship with this creator that just changed my whole life. I met this guy, I was about 3 years sober. So I got sober in Tucson, Arizona, and about a year sober, and I met my wife. So if you meet my wife this weekend, she's 9 months sober, greater than me. So basically she 13-stepped me, and she, but, look, the numbers speak the truth. I can't, I was really sensitive and vulnerable, and We were in treatment together. This is I worked there, then I became a patient there. That's how sick I am. And then I started going through the steps, and I realized they didn't need to be in treatment anymore. And they were actually closing down. There were some practices going on that were just in. I remember I was going to leave. I'd on the other end of a fifth step. I was about 2 months at this place sober, and I made a decision to leave, and she wanted to leave with me, so we left. And I remember she called her mom. I'm 12 years older than her. This sounds creepy. Not creepy today, because I'm 55. She's 43. It doesn't seem as creepy today, but at the time, she was 19. I was 31. Again, I was 5'1". I looked like I was 12. I was emotionally about 7. And she was 9 months sober longer than I am. And she told her mom, I'm leaving treatment with my boyfriend. And she's like, what? Which one was that? And she goes, remember the little guy, the bank robber who's like 30? I was 30, actually. She goes, she was not impressed. She was like furious. And most people said, we're going to get drunk. Now, I'm not saying, like, I'm not supportive of people getting hooked up in early, like in treatment centers and getting, you know, I don't think it's a recipe for success, but we were both on the other end of this transformation. We had both gone through the steps and we were kind of on the back end of it. So it wasn't like we were not, I mean, I'm not sure we were like, you know, completely transformed, but there was definitely some transformation happening. There was a psychic change in process. So it was a little bit different, but our journey together as a couple is pretty miraculous. And you want to talk about growing in sobriety. I was about 2 years sober. We moved to Maine, and most of my sobriety is up in Maine. And we moved to Maine at a year sober, moved up there, and started getting busy and living life. And really, I got a job as a salesman. She got a job, and we were just like living life, you know, sobriety, going to lots of AA meetings and, you know, GSR, and very active in AA. Doing drive-bys in AA meetings, letting people know they're not doing it right. That whole, like, everybody does that early sobriety. Like, I have the answer, you don't. Let me show you how wise I am. And no humility, a lot of arrogance, and not understanding the depth of my illness sober. Like, to not really treat my alcoholism on a daily basis. And I have some experiences. I was 2 years sober. And I remember we were arguing about something, and I don't even remember what it was. And it was probably something about who did more dishes. It was early marriage stuff. And I said, I'll never forget this. I was 2 years old, and I said, F you, and I slammed the door, and I walked out. And I raised my voice. And the way I've operated my whole life is I've never been big enough to intimidate you with my size, so I'll just, like, I'll put bass in my voice. And I'll yell. And I walked out to the parking lot, and it was objectionable. I hit my knees. I'll never forget. I hit my knees. I started crying. I begged out, please, I don't ever want to disrespect the woman I love. I don't ever want to disrespect Chloe. Please give me the power never, ever to raise my voice to her. It has been 22 years since that day, and I've never raised my voice to my wife, never. And I can't even take credit for it. When we talk about living by spiritual principles, like God, like the spiritual life's not a theory. It seems like a theory, but either I'm living it or I'm not living it. And so we've operated as a couple in a way that is, and it's really outside of my understanding, because it's most of it's me asking God for help. Help me be the man you want me to be. Help me be the father you want me to be. Help me be the husband, the son. Help me be the man that I should be, because I don't know how to be that. When I got sober at 30, I didn't have a bank account. I didn't know how to do anything. I went to prison when I was 21. I was about 22, 21, 22. Got out when I was 28. Just turning 29. I was in the youth center when I was 12. I'd been my whole life in institutions. I had no idea how to live a life. I had no idea how to write a check. I had no idea how to get a check account, get a driver's license. It was all foreign to me. And I started this way of life, and I started to have these experiences. I was about 5 years married, 5 years. And she said, I want to go to college. At about 4 years, she went to college, University of Vermont. It was an off-campus program. And after about a year of that, she would go there for 3 weeks, get her syllabus and get everything, all her studies, then come home and then do it online, and then go back every semester and meet with her, all her. It was a new program they were doing for people who had alternative lifestyles. And it was out of the University of Vermont, so it's, you know, about a 6-hour drive from where we lived. And she came back one semester and she said, hey, I got an opportunity to go to Europe to do a semester abroad. And my first thought at 5 years marriage, 5 years sobriety, was, what about me? I had this overwhelming fear leap into my head of like, okay, she's now 26, 25, 26. I'm in my mid-30s. She's going to go to Europe with a bunch of other college-age kids. Immediately, like, she's going to meet someone more handsome, taller, which is, you know, it's like middle kid schools are taller than me, you know. Like, that's not funny. I know you're laughing, but, you know, like, I go to my kid's school, and I'm like, really? Those are your friends? Like, what do they give these kids in Texas? Like, it's ridiculous. Funnier than me. You know, all these fears. And I remember going to my sponsor, like, so Chloe wants to go to Europe for 6 months. And he goes, well, what's your first thought? I said, no way. He said, well, what's that driven by? I said this when I had a list of reasons, and it had nothing to do with anything but me. Everything about me, what I'm going to lose, what I can lose. And in the end, you know, the truth was, if you ask Chloe one of the most important things in her, she's been sober 25 years, one of the best experiences she's had in her 25 years, besides like the you know, besides our kids being born, it was her experience going abroad, going to Europe and studying. And she didn't do it for 6 months. Let me tell you, it was like a 2-year process. It was like 6 months and then go back for 4 months. And I was coached by many wise people like to say, you know, like just support her. Don't, you could tell her you miss her, but don't tell her like you miss her so much that she doesn't want to do it. Like support your wife in this process. Part of growing in sobriety is like, living in a realm that doesn't mean anything about me. It's about what the people I love and what I can do for them. You know, how can I operate in a world where everything isn't about what I'm not getting or what I'm going to miss or whatever that is, and just be considerate of my wife's feelings, my wife's experience. She got sober when she was 18. She needed to experience that. I honestly think, we both had said this, we may not even be married today. If I had, like, manipulated her or convinced her, or just flat out said, I'm not gonna support that, I'm not even sure we would be married. Because when she came back, and it was, Istanbul, Turkey, Ireland, Amsterdam, when she came back, she didn't wanna go anymore. She had an opportunity, she goes, I'm tired of that, I wanna be with you. And we both realized, we don't really just need each other, we just want each other. And that was a great understanding of like, I just want to be with you, Brian, I'm done, I've had that experience. And the last experience, the last run she did 6 months in North Carolina, met a guy named Tom I. I don't know if anyone knows Tom I, but if you never have, he's an amazing man. And this man taught me what it meant to be an AA member. I remember when I, about 3 years sober, I met a guy named Don P. and from Aurora, Colorado. And Don had, I was a big book guy and I was really hungry for the big book. And so I invited Don to come to Maine to do this retreat, and him and his wife Jackie stayed. And of course, I was a type of guy who would run a committee and start a committee and start a conference or start a little group, and then I was spiritually greedy, so I'd have the speaker stay with me and stay at my house so I could get to know everything about him. And he taught me how to treat a woman. He taught me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And his hero was this guy Tom I. And Chloe was going down to Aberdeen, Southern Pines. It was right near Aberdeen where this guy Tom was. And he said, you should call Tom, he'll hook her up. And I remember calling Tom I and saying, hey, you don't know me, but I'm a friend of Don's. And he said, well, any friend of Don's is a friend of mine. What can I do for you? And I said, well, my wife's coming down to do a horse program for 6 months. And she's going to be staying in Southern Pines. And just if you could just get her connected, you know, to the women in your community. He said, absolutely. And he treated my wife like a daughter. And this man he was speaking every weekend in AA. And he went to her horse shows. He taught us what it's like to actually live these principles. We were 10 years sober when our children were born. I was 40, my wife was 28. My daughter, Quincy, she's here. She's almost 16. My son's 11, and I never thought being free was an option, and I never thought having a relationship with my Creator was optional. I never thought being married, and I definitely didn't think having kids was on the table for me. Nor did my mom and dad. Both my parents are dead. They both died. My dad died in 2012, and my mom died in 2014. And they got to see a sober son. And they used to visit me in prison. You know, they used to fly out to Michigan and Indiana and have to visit me in these places that I was just so embarrassed and so ashamed. And then they got to see their grandkids. I remember when I met Don, he had said something about, I was just hungry, spiritually hungry. I just wanted to eat it up. And because I knew that my relationship with alcohol was so powerful that if I didn't have a strong relationship with God, I would drink again. And it didn't matter what, I didn't care how much I love my wife, I would drink and give it all up. And he said, "Do you really want to know God, Brian? Like, are you really interested in knowing God?" And I said, "Oh, so much." He said, "Then get to know his kids." He says, "If you get to know God's kids, if you truly get to know God's kids, you will see God. You can see God in the sunset, on the beach, on the mountain, in the forest. But there's nothing like experiencing God in one of his children." And I started this venture of bringing AA into the prison system in the state of Maine for about 15 years. Twice a week I went, took men through the steps, did fifth steps in prison, had a room set up for me where I could only do 4 hours in a slot. That's all they could allow me. So I have to do two it was a long fifth step, and some of them were. And I have never experienced God like I have sitting knee to knee with a man who's completely broken, completely hopeless. Kids don't want to talk to him. Family doesn't want to talk to him. And you sit knee to knee and you just speak from the heart, like really from the heart. I'm going to tell you a story and then I'll close because I see Vinoy's here. Thank you for showing up. I'm 24 years sober. I'm such a baby in AA. And when I go to conferences and I see people like Marty and Vinoy and all these, the people who walk before me, I always kind of revert back to when I was like a year sober, like, okay, you know. I was 20 years sober when I had this experience. And I share this because it was a truly spiritual experience for me. And I've had quite a few in AA, but this one was, shook me to my core. And I would know at 20 years sober, if this is the experience I can have at 20 years sober, I'm so excited to wait. I mean, it was pretty painful, but on the other end, you know, was so much freedom. I had, when I was in prison, you know, prison wasn't easy for me. I was 22 years old, and I had to fight a lot, and it was a very violent world, and I come from the suburbs. My dad worked for IBM. My mom was an accountant. It's not like I grew up, you know. I mean, I was kind of a rough kid as in the sense of, like, I didn't follow rules and I was resistant to everything. But I wasn't one of those. I was scrappy, but I never had enough weight to, you know, I mean. It's like one of those guys you could just hold at your fist, you know, while he swings. That's the kind of kid I am. But if you get tired and you let your arm up and you turn your back on me, I'm going to bite you in your ankle. Yeah, that's how I operated, and it served me well on the playgrounds and in the streets. But I beat up a lot of fists with this face. Trust me. But I had this story. Now you understand. This is 20 years I kept this secret, and I have been blessed to sponsor many men and do lots of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and for 20 years I kept the secret. And I'd buried it so deep that I just didn't even think it, I didn't even think about it anymore. But the lie was, I never thought about it. The truth was, it was always there. And I was in Seattle doing a Big Book retreat. They invited me to do a Big Book weekend. So they wanted me to come. There's like 100 of them. And I'm just going to take them through the book. And they're really powerful weekends. And right on the Puget Sound, I'll never forget, at the end of the weekend, they do this Native American ceremony called a blanket ceremony. And they even asked me, like, are you okay? We're going to do this ceremony. We do it for the speakers. And I'm like, okay, well, what is it? And they said, well, we're just going to put this blanket that's been blessed, or it's been treated somehow with the elders of this local tribe, and they're going to smudge you, and we do it for everybody in the circle. And it's basically to protect the speaker. The spiritual principle is it protects the speaker on his journey. And I'm like, whatever. I'll do anything. Like, if I see a sign that says two-headed goat, I'll go check it out. Like, okay, let's see that two-headed goat. And so I'm like, all right, I'm game. And he put this blanket on me, and this guy from Seattle, old punk rocker named Loud Farts. I can't even make that name up. This is his name. My buddy from Oregon probably knows him. You know Loud Farts? Yeah, he's a real thing. He's a salt-of-the-earth kind of guy. And he's smudging me, and I got this blanket on me, and all of a sudden, I have this overwhelming presence of God. Like, overwhelming. Like, truly. And what I heard Loud say, and he told me he didn't say it, but what I heard him say was, it's okay. You're safe. It's okay. I'm here. This is what I heard. And they went around and smudged everybody, and I kept having this wave of, I want to run, I want to run, I want to run. And at the end of the ceremony, I didn't even let people talk to me. I ran out and called my wife. I didn't call my sponsor. I didn't call my therapist. But I called Chloe. Now, my relationship with Chloe is such that we know each other so well. And I called her and I said, hey, I need to tell you something. And if I don't tell you right now, I won't tell anybody. Which got her attention. The story that I had built in my mom and dad and Chloe, everybody had known this story. Everybody thought it was a true story, my brother. When I was in prison, and I was in this place called Milan, Michigan, which is like a medium security prison. It's a federal prison. And I had assaulted a guy pretty bad. And I got sent to this place called Terre Haute. Terre Haute is a maximum security prison. And I spent 9 months in solitary. I spent 9 months in a cage, and it took all my good time. I ended up doing almost the whole sentence because of this event. And they didn't know if this guy was going to live or die. They didn't know what was going to happen. So they kept me in this solitary place. And the whole time, my mom would, like, I'd have to write letters to my mom. I couldn't get a phone. The only person I could talk to was my lawyer, which I wasn't talking to. And the story I told my parents is that the guy I assaulted had stolen some money from me. And that's the story I went with for 20 years. And I told Chloe, I said, you know that story that I told you, you know that? And she said, yeah. I said, that's not what happened. I said, the night before I assaulted him and three or four of his friends came in and raped me. And beat me really bad. But took a piece of me that I can never get back. Now, when I started to share this story with her, I started to relive this whole event. Just the fear and the shame and the pain. My cellie coming in, seeing me bloody, up against the wall, just a mess, saying, you got to go to the doctors. And I said, I'm not going to the doctors. I'm not going off the yard. Him saying, well, then you got to do something about this. The depth of my anger and my hatred, I never want to feel that again. I never want to feel that dark. And my wife said the only thing that I think she could have said, which is probably why I called her. She said, I'm really sorry that happened to you. But you know that doesn't reflect who you are as a man. Because the father that I know and the husband I know resonates with God. It's just an event. I used to believe this idea that we have to accept life on life's terms. And I don't believe it. Because life has no terms. I set the terms. I decide what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I decide, like, that's okay, that's not okay. I resist that or I don't resist it. That's the deal. And the less I resist, the less pain I have. My life, since that day, at 20 years sober, has never been the same. My compassion for people was greatly enhanced. My understanding of people. Because truth is, I don't know. See, one of those things is like, well, where was God then in my cell that day? And it came to me. This came out of meditation. That was just the absence of God. See, I'm stealing this from Don, but it still resonates with me. He said, God is such a perfect gentleman. He'll never come anywhere he's not invited. Failure to invite God is what the problem is. And my resistance to inviting God around that pain and that experience is what, like, it kept me blocked. It stopped me from growing spiritually. It really did. I spent a lot of time with my kids. I get asked to speak a lot. I don't accept most speaking engagements. I probably do 6 to 8 a year. That's all I can do. I got kids that are still young. My son's 11, my daughter's 16 or 15, going on 20, whatever. I don't understand. I just like, okay. She rolled her eyes. She had a big eye roll today. I was like, wow, that was like a delayed eye roll. That was so prominent. You know, she goes, yes, I wanted you to know. I said, well, I know. I want to be there for my people. I think it's important. I love Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart. I'm a guy who shouldn't even be sober. And when I'll just end with this. When my parents died, and I did my dad's eulogy. My mom said, I want you to do your dad's eulogy. And I looked out into the pews. There was people from AA, and this is in Tucson. I mean, I haven't lived in Tucson since 1993, but there was people that I made amends to. There was drug dealers that I used to rob. There was people, I robbed a lot of banks. There was two guys in that audience whose car I used in bank robberies who I had made amends to. They came not because of my dad, they came to support me when I heard my dad died. Because we represent Alcoholics Anonymous. If any of those guys ever have a problem, I guarantee you, I know who they're gonna call. So I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful that I get to sit around and listen to guys who say at 20 years of sobriety, I stopped going to AA. Like, keeps me on my toes. I'm like, okay, I don't want that to happen to me. I'm grateful for every man that God has sent to me and say, can you help him? Because they've helped me way more than I've ever helped them, trust me. And I'm grateful to be sober. Thank you.
And I am an Al-Anon. I came into this magnificent fellowship of ours February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas. And my sponsor was Pat Clater I think I love you. Yeah. If you would bring that right over here and let me kind of lean over here, baby, right over here. Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. And she was my sponsor for 40 years. She died, I guess it's 8 years ago, and now I have this sweet little lady, and Warwick, Oklahoma, named Nell. And she's been my sponsor now for, I guess, 8 years. First of all, I am absolutely mortified that I didn't know that I was on this panel. I was just hanging out. Actually, it's Brenda's fault, my companion. I got up and I said, well, we need to get dressed to go to that panel. I thought it was a couple doing marriage. And she said, you know, you pushed yourself really hard yesterday. Maybe you should kind of just cool it and I may just take an easy morning. I didn't sleep well, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I made the decision, which my gut said, this is not right. You don't do this. You go to the meetings. My hair was in curlers. I had no makeup on. And bam, bam, bam. I mean, the whole place rocked. It was that dumb Dave beating on my door. He said, you're supposed to be in a meeting speaking. And let me tell you, Dave, you can pass the word to him. There's only 3 men that's ever seen me without makeup and curlers. And the 2 of the other ones are dead. I'm going to tell you first how I'm growing right now. You've seen me waddling around here and staggering like crazy. I have visual vertigo, and I've had it for 7 months. I have been housebound for 7 months. They don't know the cause. There is no cure. All they can do is treat the symptoms. This is my first trip out in 7 months. And I want to tell you, there ain't nobody on the planet happier than I am right this minute. There's nobody. I cannot heal and I cannot grow without y'all. That I know. And I told Mari, I said, I had to come. I had to be with her. She is so, I mean, you can hardly describe Mari. She's so full of love and kindness that just being in her presence, you're going to feel better. You're going to be okay. And I knew if I could sit around with her, I'd be okay when I got here. And thank you, Brenda, for coming with me and taking care of me. And all you just... beyond all, I love this committee. And so for 7 months, I've had to sit in my house. Now, I am extremely active. I go, 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 go. I do a lot of things. And being alone is not, you know, something that I prefer. So for 7 months, I've had to truly, truly work on, it's just Saturday. I'm okay Saturday. And it is what it is. There's nothing I can do about it today, so it's just Saturday. And speaking with my sponsor a lot and people bringing me meetings, it has been a growing experience for me to do nothing. It's been a hard experience for me to say, can you help me? I busted out bawling yesterday. I mean, they were trying to help me and be kind and... it really, I don't want that. I don't need that. Thank you very much. I can handle this myself. I don't know if that's a character defect or not, but... the art of accepting and receiving kindness. Kindness is my word for this year. I've heard it everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And I have received it over and over and over. It's just amazing. So I have patience now that I probably wouldn't have had because of this. My sponsor told me, write some things that's coming, that's good out of this. Well, I got a new TV. I didn't have a smart TV, so one of my sponsees and her husband shipped me a brand new TV. Now, man, there's nothing wrong with that. Another friend gave me Netflix, and because I had everything I could watch, I had watched, and I was down to Dr. Phil. And it made a bunch of them nervous because I had techniques that I had learned, and so I got a new TV. I have had people coming to my house, bringing me food, bringing me meals, taking me places that I needed to go, and it is receiving, and it's been one of the hardest chores that I've done. And I realized that if I'm giving to you, I have a little power. But if I'm receiving from you, there's not much power that. And I have been around here a long time, and I know what to do. Thank you. And people come over and want to pray for me. Don't pray over me. That's ew. Out of the love and kindness, it's just been amazing. My first spurt of growing would have to be when I came in. I came in married to an extremely violent, angry, drunk. And I came here looking for a way to get out of that. Now, I want to say real quick, when I got here and I was given the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to study, and I don't debate that and I don't want to, I grew up on the big book. And I was given that book to read what the disease of alcoholism looks like. And then I was to read it and look and see how that disease looked like me. And I'll tell you, it is a true fact. They talk about the isms of alcoholism. I believe with all my heart there's isms of Al-Anon. And my sponsor used to say, the horns in his head fit the holes in my head. All I came here is for a little while to find out how to stop him drinking, if he would just stop drinking. And I learned really quick, very quick. Marty was saying it last night, you know, to shut up and get in the car. I mean, we didn't have any, well, let's talk about your feelings and all that. I mean, it just wasn't done. And they didn't care if you use AA or Al-Anon, they would tell you shut up and sit down. I grew up in a group that was a family-oriented group, and I was taught in the beginning to go to open AA meetings, committed every week just like my Al-Anon meetings were committed. And I can't tell you which of the meetings helped most, the AA or the Al-Anon. They were what I needed. So I came here trying to figure out what to do with him and studying that big book. And it was pointed out to me, in the doctor's opinion, I really learned this. There's no blame here. I mean, there's no blame here. Everybody's got a part. It's just no blame. And in that doctor's opinion, it talks about the alcoholic being mentally defective. And it says in there, the alcoholic is in full flight from reality. Full flight from reality. Now, if that alcoholic turns around and looks to see who's behind him, chasing him just as hard as they can, wanting to hang on, don't leave me, don't leave me. Now who's sick? You know, I am attracted to somebody who's in full flight from reality. Some nutcase. Oh my God, I love them. This is it. This is the one. This is the one. My husband at the time was a cowboy, and he rodeoed. He was in the national finals for bull riding, and he had the arms of a bull rider, and he could hit me a clear across the house in 2 seconds. And I always thought if I could pick up something and go back, I could knock him down. And that's how I thought I was a victim. For years, I thought I was a victim because he was violent and we got after it. And so was my first, I've had three major alcoholics, plethora of them in between. You better show up. Come in here banging my door and like that and then not even show up. Scaring the crap out of me. And you made me forget where I was.
Plethora in between.
Oh, yes. But this one I caught. And I would just bust anything over his head, anything. And he wasn't as violent as my first major one. So when I got here and listened to you guys and women talk about what was going on at your house during the drinking years, it was going on at my house last night. So I listened to you. How did you do it? How did you stay? What was your magic tricks? I could not leave. Now you ask an alcoholic, why don't you quit drinking? And they can't tell you. They're gonna lie around it and skip over it and jump over it. My sponsor's husband, Jack, was so meaningful to me and helpful to me. He said, if they ever tell you why, or if they tell you they don't know, then that means they have to do something about it. So they will never tell you why. And when people would ask me, why do you stay there? Well, I couldn't say, I don't know. I would say, well, I'm leaving as soon as the kids get out of school. I'm leaving as soon as I get some money saved up. I'm leaving as soon as the car. I'm leaving as soon as. And this one day I couldn't do it anymore. And I got here. And they started telling me about the disease of alcoholism. They started telling me how dark and deep and soul covering up with the blackness, and how I stood there and participated in that because of my Al-Anon-isms. We made a list of them. There's a long list. And the Al-Anon-isms that I'm talking about is control. We like to control things. I don't know why. We just do. I know why I do, because I know best, you know. I know how to fix everything. Fear, manipulation, lack of humor, no self-esteem, vindictive, manipulative, you know, just all these things in me just needed the alcoholic for that to all fit. It fit, and I could function there. And I stayed here, and I learned things, and I did things, and I changed. I met God of my understanding here for the first time in my life. And the drunk cowboy was getting madder and madder and madder, more furious and more furious. And I knew, my growth told me he cannot stop doing what he's doing. He just couldn't. And I knew that. And I had two little kids that was growing up in this violent, violent house. Violent. And I finally divorced him. And then I was single in this fellowship. Man, you had to be very careful in this fellowship because there's single AA men everywhere. And I had two watchdogs. My sponsor and her husband watched me because I was trying to live a life of integrity. And they introduced me to a thing called 13-stepping that I would not do. And why? Why not do it? I'm single. I'm having a good time. Conventions, I fell in love with conventions the first time I ever walked into one. I mean, I was a junkie and I have been ever since. I love it here. I love it here. I could not wait just to sit in the meeting last night. I just, I, I can't even tell you. I just can't even tell you. I loved being here. And there was dances. You know how important the dances are at a convention. You've got to be careful trolling. And I was taught how to be a woman of dignity and grace in this fellowship, and how to handle myself. Prior to here and prior to that couple of marriages, I was easily called a slut puppy hoe. Because that next man was going to be it. That next man. Maybe the next man. So I had a nice path going this way. I had no earthly idea how to date. None. My dating was get your tightest jeans on that you could possibly get, low-cut blouse, get your girlfriends, go out the honky-tonk and start looking. That was the only dating I knew. And I had to be taught how to date. And I want to tell you, it's kind of boring. get to know each other and become friends and da-da-da. And then I met a sober man from California, came to a little convention that we all went to. I met him. His name was Jim Shaw, and had the bluest eyes and the deepest voice and the biggest diamonds I'd ever seen, and they all attracted me. And we started a long-distance relationship, and I had to learn what that meant. What does that mean, and how are you going to do that? And I was told, not only by my sponsor, but by y'all. You know, people would share with me. We would talk about it. You know, we used to set up way, way late talking about our hymns and our husbands and our boyfriends, and first thing we'd do when we started seeing each other is, who's you going with, what you doing? You know what we do now? Are you easily constipated now? What do you take for your indigestion? You know, that's, Marty, what's the first thing we start talking about? How sick we'd been, both of us. That's what we talk about now. And it's exciting, I want to see what's coming down the pike towards me, you know? And finally, I made all these arrangements to move to California, and he helped, to see if we could date. How long am I supposed to talk? Am I through? Huh? 20 minutes, okay, I'm about there. And so he dumped me that first round. I didn't see him for 2 years. That was a growing session, I'll tell you. And then I finally caught him, and we got married. And I moved to California. I left my home group and went to a whole new state of fruit and nuts. They're not teasing when they say that, California. And I had to once again switch everything. I left everything I'd ever known in Texas. And here I was in California. And I had to start anew with a new program, new friends, new life. And you know, I had watched y'all. You'd come in and you'd be smiling and hugging, and you'd go around, speak to everybody, and wave goodbye and get in your car. And I thought, this is so wonderful. Look how those couples do. I just never was in the car on your way home or in the car coming to the meeting to hear all the fighting and snarling and scratching. You know, we do good in the meeting, but as soon as that door hits you, the real people come out. So I had to learn, and he had to learn, how to be married in sobriety and how that looks and how that worked. And we sat in meetings like this. We talked to old timers on how to do it. And how to be a woman in sobriety and in Al-Anon without a crutch of him. And I'm amazed at my life. I'm just completely and totally amazed at my life. We were sitting on the porch enjoying coffee while y'all were at the meeting this morning, and saying how, and I know all of you said this, how did we get here? I mean, I was living in a shack in the country with two kids and a drunk that came home and beat me all the time. And I had no money. I had a car that I had to take big gallon of water to halfway to work to stop and put the water in the radiator. And how in the world did I get to Puerto Vallarta with all you beautiful people? How did that happen? My life is just overwhelms me. I'm just overwhelmed. This very day, this minute, I love recovery so much. And as Marty said last night several times, I love the music here. I love it. I seek it. I'm so hungry for it. And this very day, this moment, I am so in love with my God. I love him. That he took somebody like me, plucked me out of a shack, and put me on a porch in Puerto Vallarta. I am so absolutely grateful for my life. Thank you very much.